Welcome back to Decouple. Today I'm joined by Art Berman. Art is someone who I've been following for a while now. I think probably I discovered you through Nate Hagen's podcast, The Great Simplification, but I've been a big fan of your blog. And, you know, I've been reading so many articles, I've kind of forgot to do my own little research into exactly who you are. So I know you're an energy expert, you're a speaker, you're a friend of Nate Hagen's, a mutual friend. Tell us a little bit more about yourself before we jump in, so our guests have an idea of, you know, your expertise, your formation, your values, whatever you got, but you only got about 60 to 90 seconds. So take it away, Art.
Okay, well, it won't take that long. So I'm a geologist. I've worked in the energy business now for 45 years, worked for Big Oil for about half of that. I've been a consultant ever since, and most of what I do today is sort of on the macro side of things, trying to integrate all the various imaginary ideas that everybody has for whatever energy transition we think we're involved in, and to try to help people understand how that fits into the perspective of larger systems, human behavior, and what is feasible or reasonable versus what we imagine to be all of those things. So that's what I do these days. But yeah, my original work was all in oil and gas. I still do some of that. I guess more and more it's the broader energy picture and sort of the climate change ecological crisis that I'm most interested in.
Right on. Well, we're big fans of the cold hard truth here. And you know, I'd say, you know, over my journey as a total outsider, right? I'm an emergency medicine physician by training and got fascinated by energy over the climate change issue, sort of found nuclear as a bit of a panacea. And I think I've matured a little bit in my outlook on this, but we do a lot on the podcast in terms of energy analysis, looking at the climate debate, even some of the philosophical underpinnings, the romantic origins of the environmental movement, et cetera. So Art, you're in good company here. And we're glad to have you. You know, I've been reading a few of your articles. There's been a lot of great stuff in this peak cheap oil debate. You had a great response, I believe, to Doomberg and Adam Rosenzweig's recent appearance on Thoughtful Money, which I'd love to jump into. Very interested in talking about the Biden pause on LNG. LNG export facilities, and maybe what some of the underlying energy or realpolitik is behind that. Certainly interested in a little bit of a discussion of what I'll call energy quality returned on energy quality invested, both in terms of renewables, I guess, as well as sort of unconventional oils and, you know, gas to liquids processes. And maybe a little cherry on top, we'll talk nuclear at the end. I think we have some shared opinions and some differences, but vive la difference. I love living in a world of well-argued differing opinions. So anyway, why don't we jump in a little bit on the topic of peak cheap oil, something we've covered before. We've chatted with Nate about it. We've had Lee Gehring on to talk about potential peak shale. We've had a bit of a back and forth. It's been really interesting. I think you were involved maybe with the oil drum, but you've been talking peak oil for a while. When did it go from peak oil to peak cheap oil? What's the difference? Let's just get situated there with a few kind of quick questions to make sure we're all talking about the same things.
Yeah. Well, peak oil got off track very early on. The folks who originated, I think, the discussion in the 90s were actually talking about the end of cheap oil. I mean, that was the Scientific American article that kicked it off. Obviously, King Hubbert, you know, way back in the 50s and 60s was the the fellow who originated the, I guess he didn't come up with the concept, but everybody attributed peak oil to him. But originally, from my perspective, it never was about when will supply or production peak. It all had to do with are we done with cheap, abundant oil supply? And in my estimation, the answer to that was and is yes. That ended. Cheapest oil we ever had in real dollars was in 1998. And that we haven't approached anything close to that. We've gone up, we've gone down. But, you know, I think a lot of people, they just take a a very short-term, narrow view of oil prices. So if oil prices are, you know, got to 140 or 50 bucks in 2008, that was high. And if they got to, you know, negative 37 in 2020, that was low, and everything else in between, you know, whatever. But I look at it in a sort of a simpler way, which is if oil in real terms, let's just say for argument's sake, it's twice as expensive or three times as it was in 1998, then, you know, I don't really care about the peak cheap oil debate, but since we're talking about it, then it's over. We're done. Oil is significantly more expensive than it was in 1998. And let's move on, because I don't really care about, you know, inventing some argument like, you know, Doomberg and Adam Rosenzweig were talking about. I mean, the real discussion isn't whether a myth is right or not. That's a human construct. The real discussion is, what is the human and planetary predicament, and what do oil prices have to do with it? And again, I'm not in any way criticizing that discussion. I mean, that was the subject they were given, and they, you know, they discussed it. So I just think it was the wrong, well, I wouldn't want to discuss that subject, right, let's put it right that way, because it's, you know, yeah.
So, I mean, it seems like what you're pointing at is the differences between the actual cost to produce a barrel of oil versus what we end up paying in terms of the consumer price. And obviously, God, I get this wrong a lot, but the price inelasticity of demand means that oil can undergo big, you know, cycles, et cetera. But is that what you're getting at in terms of just like energy, return on energy invested? What kind of metric is used to sort of say that 1998 was sort of peak cheap oil? If it's not the price of a barrel.
Okay, so price of a barrel is fine. All I'm saying is that if you take that price and you adjust it for inflation or you know, just normalize it in some way, and you know, you can normalize it to December 2023 US dollars, and it, you know, any way you want to cut it, oil was never cheaper for the consumer out of our collective pockets than it was in 1998. End of discussion. So to me, I mean, you know, in Doomberg, I don't know what he does with, you know, with somehow looking at the price of gold and as if that really matters. But, you know, for most ordinary people, and I include myself and you, Chris, and that, you know, we decide if oil is expensive or not by how much money it costs us to fill up our car. Okay. Assuming that we have a gasoline or a diesel powered car, and I just filled mine and, you know, it cost me pretty nearly 50 US dollars. And I can remember a time not very many years ago where it cost me maybe 35. And so from my limited perspective, it costs me more today than it did then. Therefore, the price of oil is more. And I don't care about what gold says, or I don't care about, you know, anything else. I just know that that's a fact. And when I go to the grocery store with my wife and, you know, and she says, gosh, you know, the same pound of fish or whatever, you know, it used to cost me this and now it's 2x that. And I say, well, yeah, that's because the price of energy is more, and that translates into everything. And that's what I would like people to understand, is that energy is the economy. And when the cost of energy increases, then the cost of everything, the cost of doing business, the cost of gasoline, the cost of fish, whatever you want to talk about, it all goes up, because it is the basis of doing all business. Now, it's not proportional, it's not equivalent. I mean, the price of oil goes up 5% and maybe the cost of gasoline goes up 15%, but it always goes up. And that's the bottom line. That's what people don't understand. And people think, oh, well, you know, inflation, I mean, that's a policy problem. No, it's not. Inflation is because the cost of energy went way up after the pandemic for a variety of reasons. The economy came back to life, Russia invaded Ukraine, you know, name your poison. But the bottom line is that inflation is not, you know, it's an abstract concept, and it responds to the underlying cost of everything, which eventually is based on energy. And so, you know, well, people in the U.S., I don't know what people do in Canada. Maybe they blame Trudeau. People in the U.S. blame Biden. Well, guess what? Inflation is a global phenomenon. And I don't think that Trudeau or Biden are powerful enough, even though they're powerful, to create inflation in Hungary or Australia. I mean, inflation is a global phenomenon because the price of energy costs more than it did in 2020. You know, again, end of story for me. But I don't expect everybody to, you know, to understand the logic behind that. But what I want everybody to, you know, at least the people listening to this podcast to understand is that energy is the currency of life. Ask any animal, they get it. They may not be able to speak it in language, but they get it totally. Humans don't get it. Humans think that the economy is about money. But you know, money doesn't have any value. Money is just a way that we exchange value underlying it, and that value is work or energy. I mean, everybody, I think, can admit that the economy is based on work.
Yeah, I mean,
people work. That's what makes the economy run.
I think it's a product of energy having been just so incredibly cheap and abundant for so long that you take for granted even the most important things around you. But Art, I wanted to introduce you to a little equation that I've been working on to try and understand our human predicament, to understand the hockey stick of GDP growth with the Industrial Revolution. I'm familiar with saying, well, it's just because of fossil energy, and that's definitely a big part of it. I came up with this kind of equation. It's got three variables in it. One is materials, one is innovation or technology, and the other is energy. And they exist in this kind of dynamic equilibrium. Innovation and technology don't progress unless you have energy and materials. And what I think is the source of the limits that we're running into right now is that our materials are decreasing in quality. Our ore grades, et cetera, are going down. And we've been able to paper that over with more and more abundant, cheap energy, such that, you know, as ore grades, say, in Chilean copper mines go down, we can put more energy in the form of ammonium nitrate, blow up bigger rocks, make bigger pits, have larger trucks fired by, you know, diesel electric motors and move more rock, crush more of it. The energy sort of papers over that. But the moment that we start running into constraints on material quality, which is natural, we've, as human beings, just like any other organism you're mentioning, we'll go for the easiest sources of nutrients, whether that be material or energy first, that means that that's come down. And you know, I think what we're starting to see maybe, and people like you and I are worrying about, is that the energy quality is starting to decrease, or even that we're making policy choices to try, probably quite in vain, to move and transition towards energy sources that have a lower energy return on energy invested or produce lower quality energy. So with that as a bit of a framing, I want to understand just, you know, in terms of that master resource of energy and probably the master of the holy trinity of fossil fuels, oil. What is oil? Because that seems to be a contentious issue right now. If you can break down what oil is, how we define it, and so we can talk about peak. What is actually peak and cheap?
Well, good. So oil is crude oil, which is a liquid, at least at surface temperature and pressure, that contains all sorts of very long chain complex molecules made of hydrogen and carbon. Okay, it is a liquid, and in and of itself, it's not very useful for anything except to refine. And when it's refined, it can be converted by distillation into very useful products like gasoline and kerosene and jet fuel and, you know, a variety of other things. And so when people, when we hear, you know, the International Energy Agency or somebody on CBC or CNN says, oh, well, you know, oil demand is expected to go to 102 million barrels a day. Well, that's crude oil plus a bunch of other stuff. Okay. That includes other stuff like natural gas liquids. That includes, you know, other things like the volume change when you put something very dense like oil into a refinery and out come less dense products like gasoline and kerosene. There's a volume change of a few barrels there. So there's crude oil, and then there's a bunch of stuff that's laid on top of that. So the what's commonly called oil, fair enough, you know, let's call it oil, but it's an awful lot of it today comes from natural gas, which doesn't really have anything to do with oil at all. So when you hear 100 million barrels a day of supply or demand or whatever, understand that the crude oil part, which is the critical part from an energy density standpoint, is about, it's about 80%. About 80% of what's called oil is oil. Now, Doomberg wants to, you know, he thinks he just discovered sex and that he's the first guy that figured out that, you know, that there's a lot more going, there's a lot more in the definition of oil than crude oil. And I don't know why, he's a smart guy. I don't know why he thinks that somehow everybody else missed that. I've been in this business 45 years and 45 years ago, somebody sat me down and said, okay, this is what's oil. And natural gas liquids and all these other kinds of things have always been part of oil. So, but your point that I think is important here, Chris, is about quality. And so what can we do with crude oil that cannot be done with natural gas liquids? And so, for instance, the majority of natural gas liquids, these are liquids that come from natural gas. They don't, you have to process them through a plant. But the predominant one is ethane. Okay. And most people don't even know what ethane is, or do they care about it? But ethane, the biggest use of ethane is to make plastic bags. Okay. It's sort of a plastic feedstock. It's also used as a bad substitute for methane, which is natural gas. But I mean, ethane is probably, I don't know, it's 50 or 60% of natural gas liquids. So right off the bat, you're talking about something that while it can be used as a fuel, for the most part, isn't. It's used to make baggies, okay? That's not 100% true, but just to keep it simple. Okay, and then the next thing, the next biggest thing is propane. And, you know, propane and a lot of people, particularly in rural areas, heat their houses with propane. So it is a fuel and that's great. But, and there are propane trucks and, you know, and buses in some cities. But for the most part, you know, you can't just pull up to a gas station and put propane in your car. Okay. You can't run a jet with it. It's not the same. Butane is another natural gas liquid. We use that, you know, for lighters, Bic lighters and stuff like that. It burns. It's a fuel, but you know, it's not a transport fuel. I guess that's the bottom line.
And why not? Why not, Art? Is it,
you know, all these natural,
is it just an issue of the,
it's too light.
Okay.
It doesn't have the heavy hydrocarbons that give it the energy density that's needed to power a car or an airplane or, you know, or whatever. So it all comes down, you were talking about energy invested versus energy return. I mean, you know, you can say, I mean, okay, so let's go back. I don't want to criticize Doomberg so much, except that he made himself so damn vulnerable with all these goofy arguments. So, I mean, you know, is all alcohol the same, for instance? I mean, if I like whiskey and somebody offers me, you know, 3.2% beer, I'm going to say, forget that, buddy. You know, I said I wanted alcohol. Oh, but they're both alcohol. Well, okay, yeah, but one of them, the 3.2 beer or even 6% beer, it doesn't have anywhere near the, you know, the buzz that whiskey does. Okay, crude oil has a buzz, and natural gas liquids are 3.2% beer by comparison.
So am I understanding Doomberg's argument correctly? You know, Jesus turned water into wine, but I think there's this idea that we can turn beer into whiskey. And I don't know enough about distilling, but potentially you could distill beer into a higher alcohol concentration. When talking about, you know, anything that goes into refinery is oil, and sort of we can just do complex chemical engineering to create whatever hydrocarbon molecule we want.
Sure.
I was chatting with a friend who's involved in the heavy oils up in the oil sands, and we were talking about refining and the analogy of fission versus fusion. So, you know, fissioning or breaking apart these really long, heavy hydrocarbon chains to make, you know, products that you want, maybe diesel or maybe more gas. I don't know why you want more gasoline. Or, you know, fusing these lighter hydrocarbon chains together to make heavier oils. Can you do that? You know, is it just a, you know, a big enough investment,
sure,
in a refinery?
Yeah,
or is there big energetic cost?
You know, okay. So again, you know, this is discovering sex and thinking you're the first person that's ever done it, and you really want to tell the rest of the world about it because it feels so great. So, I mean, this process of taking natural gas and turning it into diesel and gasoline, You know, this was something that was figured out back in the early part of the 20th century, and Germany wanted to use it to power its army because Germany didn't have a hell of a lot of oil, and so you know, if we're talking about hydrogen and carbon, which is what we're talking about, that's what oil is, that's what natural gas is, then if in a perfect world, all I need is enough, you know, the right combination of carbon and hydrogen, and I can make anything. I can make, you know, crude oil, gasoline, kerosene, whatever. But the question is, as you correctly point out, what is the energetic cost of doing that? And not to mention the, you know, the money cost of doing that. And so Doomberg talked about this Pearl GTL plant, gas to liquids is what GTL means, in Qatar. Well, you know, I looked at that in some detail, and the energy out versus the energy in is about 1-to-1. Okay, so it sucks. I mean, you know, no intelligent animal would choose a food source, you know, no elephant, no lion, no fish, that only gave it the amount of energy that it took to eat it. I mean, that's just stupid, okay? So why does Shell have a GTL plant in Qatar? Well, because Qatar supplies all the natural gas for free, because Qatar has this gigantic gas field off in the Persian Gulf that is what we call stranded, okay? There's no way to market the gas. They take as much of it as they can and convert it into LNG, you know, liquefied natural gas, and send it to Europe and whatever. And there's still tons and tons of it left. So they're interested in let's use this stranded resource. And we don't care about either the energy, the energetic budget, or the money. We don't care about either of those. So, hey, Shell, build us a shell, build us a plant, and we'll make all your costs go away. And you can make gasoline and kerosene. And isn't that cool? Okay, but in the real world, I mean, is that realistic? I mean, is that something that we're going to do? And so you mentioned early in this discussion innovation, okay? And I mean, we are great worshipers, we as a civilization, at the altar of innovation and technology. And you know, I mean, I like technology, I like innovation, who doesn't? But realistically, I mean, innovation and technology are castaways on this gigantic ship, which is powered by giant diesel engines, and they are too naive to know that the boat is running on giant diesel engines underneath their feet. So in real terms, if you calculate the impact of technology and innovation on energy efficiency, it's about 1% per year. Okay. I mean, it's good. It's nice. I mean, let's do it. We are smart. We figure out better ways of doing things. But I mean, if somebody offers me, hey, you know, I'm going to pay you 1% of your current salary to come to work for me, I'm going to tell them to go take a hike. You know, I'm not interested. I mean, that's a rounding error. So again, I'm not in any way, you know, saying that innovation and technology aren't important, but they're a very small piece of the overall picture. It's just we've pumped them up, you know, to imagine that they're everything. And in energy, technology is just, it's a bigger straw. It's just it's a quicker way of getting more energy out faster. And I'm not saying that's not important, but it doesn't create energy. It does not create energy. It just sucks it out faster. And there's some value to that, no doubt.
So, yeah, again, getting back to that equation, Stephen Keen, an economist that Nate's had on the podcast, I think that's how I discovered him, has this great saying.
I know Steve. Yeah, he's
so
perfect. He's
great. Technology without energy is a sculpture. But I heard a few more. This isn't from Steve. This is from a Twitter reply to that. Energy without technology is a fire. And then I just added another one on here, which is innovation without energy is a hand axe, you know, going back to Homo erectus or something, right? So there's this complex interplay. I want to get to this idea of people kind of losing track of, you know, energy source, energy carrier, just the incredible amount of energy blindness that's around us. Because I had a very interesting conversation again with my friend Chris Popoff, who has worked significantly in the oil sands in Alberta. And what he was saying, the kind of analogy he was making, is that we are turning unconventional oil, for instance, in the case of bitumen, we're sort of using the local energy reserves of Alberta, which are plentiful natural gas and this hard to extract bitumen. We're turning the bitumen into a battery. We're charging it with this natural gas, similar to the Pearl GTL facility where the gas is stranded, or, you know, you can't get it to market in Alberta, or et cetera. I mean, I guess that's the same situation in Qatar. So you're using that energy kind of for free to create a molecule, to store that energy into a molecule that you can sell that does have economic value. I just found that's interesting because you see that with hydrogen. You know, we're confusing an energy carrier, like politicians do this all the time, thinking it's an energy source. We have a lot of delusions around, say, grid scale batteries and being able to, you know, balance the Rube Goldberg machine of you know, an all renewable grid, for instance. So maybe comment a little bit on some of that, if you don't mind.
Sure. So I think the fundamental thing, I mean, people can get really, really glazed over and confused by what you just said and what I just have said. And in the interest of of keeping it relatively simple, let's just do it this way. That another Canadian, Václav Schmeel, used to teach up in the University of Manitoba. He described what he called the four pillars of civilization. These are four things without which civilization will collapse: steel, concrete, plastic, and ammonia for fertilizer. Okay. Now, of those four things, we don't know how to produce any of them at scale without fossil fuels. Period. That's it. We don't know how to do it. It's not technically possible. So without steel, we have no buildings. Without concrete, we have no buildings and no highways. Without plastic, we have no electric cars because, well, electric cars are mostly steel and plastic. Okay. Next time you go into a hospital, you know, or go for a medical checkup, look around the room and see how much plastic is in there. I mean, the healthcare industry is one of the largest consumers of plastic in the world. So we shut down our entire healthcare system without plastic. And ammonia, I mean, if it weren't for the fertilizer that comes from ammonia, which comes from natural gas, the Earth's population might be 2 billion, which would be a better thing for the planet, but it's 8 billion, and it's 8 billion because fertilizer has increased the carrying capacity of the planet. So, you know, so right off the bat, none of the things that hold up our civilization are possible without fossil fuels. And for those who want to get off of them, and I'd love to get off of them too, but I'd also like to get off of them in a way that doesn't crater the whole civilization and create mass pandemonium and, you know, and war and starvation and a lot of other things. So, you know, I don't have an answer to that, but it's not binary, you know, it's not either or. And I hear anybody who says we need to get off of fossil fuels, or people that say, oh no, we need to have more of them, I'm sure they're both wrong, or at least that they have no comprehension about what they're talking about. So for the average person, all we want to do is just have our lives be more or less okay. And I promise you that without the right fuels to provide us with these four pillars of civilization, our lives will not be okay, at least okay in terms of, you know, whatever we think is normal. So keep that in mind when you hear people who talk about, well, we want to do this, we want to do that, we want to transition away from, and I always say, great, transition away from fossil fuels to what? And what will those four pillars of civilization, what will my life look like after that? And if somebody answers me honestly and says, oh, well, your life will be a lot more difficult, you will be poorer, the world will be poorer, but, you know, we're going to have a planet that's more in balance with the kinds of things that make the quality of life on Earth better. Okay, now I know what I'm signing up for. When people say, "Oh, look, you know, all you got to do is go for our, you know, Green New Deal or the energy transition, and nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to change except you're going to be driving an electric car instead of a regular car." But life, I was going to say that's a lie. It's only a lie if the people saying it know it's a lie. If they honestly believe it, in other words, then it's not a lie, but it isn't true. It's just not true. And I'm not trying to be pessimistic or negative here. It's just back to your point, Chris, and that is if you're using energy sources that are 3-2 beer instead of Scotch whiskey, you're going to get a different. You don't have the same input. You're not going to get the same output.
You're not going to stay drunk for very long, or yeah,
you're not going to get drunk very well either.
Well, there was alcohol consumed in huge amounts before fossil fuels, but life back then was also nasty, brutish, and short. And I think a lot of people are fooling themselves when they think it wouldn't be in the future without it. Unfortunately, I, like you, would love to see a beautiful utopia and everything in balance, but we have to remember that we didn't live in harmony with nature. We died in harmony with nature, and it was mostly, you know, children under 8 and women in childbirth. So it'd be lovely not to have to go back there, but still find some good solutions. Before we get into even talking about solutions, I want to, you know, dig your brain, maybe horizontally frack your brain to understand a little bit more about the shale revolution. So, I mean, this really, more than anything, I think, put discussion about peak cheap oil on the back burner. The U.S. this year announced its, you know, highest production ever, 13.2 million barrels per day.
13.2. Oh my God. 13.
I'm behind. So absolutely extraordinary. Can you talk to us a little bit about the significance of the shale revolution? And then we'll sort of get to where we are at right now, the Red Queen problem, et cetera. Take it away, Art.
Sure. So oil prices went from their all-time low in 1998 to their all-time high in 2008 in a brief 10 years because nobody knew where the next barrel of oil was going to come from. That all the discoveries that were being made were in very remote, hard-to-access places that took 8 or 10 years to get from discovery to first oil. And by the time they did, older fields were depleted. So we were on a treadmill. We weren't increasing or decreasing our supply of oil, and yet the population of the earth kept growing. And so the peak oil discussion grew up around the fact that, oh my God, I mean, we have a big problem. We have a big problem starting now, and it's going to get worse unless we figure out how to change this. And so shale came along, not that it was anything new. I mean, the big oil companies have been studying and evaluating the shale basins for as long as I've been in the oil business, 50 years. Okay, nothing is new. Everybody knows what's out there. There just wasn't the oil sands, same thing. I mean, oil sands didn't really take off. They false started a few times, but they didn't really take off until around 2005, 2006, when investors said, you know what? I think oil prices are going to stay high for a long enough period that this makes sense. Okay, the same thing happened with shale. And so these resources that we always knew were there, suddenly, or not suddenly, but eventually, there was a belief in a long enough period of high prices that people finally said, okay, let's figure out how to make this work. And so ever since then, ever since about 2010, the only growth in world oil supply, and we're talking, you know, crude oil or the whole shebang, you know, the Bloomberg, everything is oil. The only growth has been from shale. Okay, so the only thing that's keeping our heads above water, so to speak, as far as not having a gross undersupply of energy, is shale. Okay, so I cannot understate the significance that shale bought the world 10 or 15 years of supply that we didn't think we had. All right, that's the good news. The bad news is that those fields, and they are fields, are starting, they're approaching or have peaked, depends on which one you're talking about. And the physics of a fluid flow in the Earth says that once they peak, they're going to start to decline. And so what I see happening is we are returning to the same situation we were in 2005. We're not there. We won't be there for a while. I'm not, you know, the sky is not falling. These fields are not going to stop producing, but they're going to be progressively producing less and less, and it's going to cost more and more, as it does for all fields. Okay, there's nothing that, let me put this differently. The way that we drill and complete shale wells is very different from conventional wells. Once discovered, a shale well is exactly like any other oil well. It produces, it peaks, it declines. A shale play is just a fancy word for a field. And it behaves exactly like any other
except
field.
In fast forward,
some fields decline.
Except
how in fast forward? What do you mean?
Oh, I mean, it seems like those wells, their lifespans are much shorter. They produce much quicker, but they're...
Oh, they decline. Well, yeah. So, I mean, this is true for conventional oil too. It just depends. I mean, for instance, the thing that makes offshore and deep water commercially viable is that it produces huge volumes early on in its life, declines quickly, but that pays back the gigantic investment. So, you know, in general, you're kind of right, but there's this sort of critical interplay between rates and reserves that most people not only don't, but probably don't need to understand. But so there's nothing, you know, the high rate of return is a good thing. I mean, you know, I wish that the government would give me, you know, all of the money they took from me as Social Security tomorrow, as opposed to, you know, dole it out a few thousand dollars a month, because it's worth more to me today than it will be in 10 years. So, but in general, yeah, the shale wells do decline quickly, and therefore this is your Red Queen analogy. So we have to keep drilling more and more wells to keep the production level up. And what I've discovered, and I've you know posted about this, it's all free at artberman.com, is that the quality or the amount of oil that we're going to get out of newly drilled wells is less than wells that were drilled just a year or two ago. Okay, and that's a very clear trend and exactly completely expected and predictable. Give, you know, any oil field you look at, it's not like, oh my God, what happened? What went wrong? Nothing went wrong. That's the way oil fields peak and then decline. So what I'm saying, back to where I started, is we're starting another cycle where pretty soon, when people understand what's happening, we're not going to know where the next barrel of oil is going to come from that's going to keep us from having a big shortage and therefore higher prices in the world, unless something happens like the global economy craters, which it may, or, you know, we just decide to use a whole lot more oil, which and energy, which, by the way, is the solution to the planetary and the climate crisis. Nobody wants to think about it, but that it's a very clear and obvious solution. But if business as usual, we're embarking on a period of prolonged scarcity and therefore higher prices for energy. And that's a problem for all of us.
So I've seen this, I haven't been able to deep dive the source literature, but this near 99.9% correlation between energy use and GDP and energy use and materials. You know, Doomberg and others postulate that, you know, there'll be a 2% addition of supply year over year over year. It's kind of convenient because that's sort of the target for economic growth. If the shale revolution had not occurred, if that additional supply had not come on, would you think it'd be fair to say that economic growth would not have been able to proceed 2% per year? And if shale does peak, like is oil in particular so tightly coupled to GDP that we're likely to see the economy cease growing or that 2% growth rate stop if we truly do peak those shales and there's not another supply, say Russian shales that come on?
Yes. Simple answer, yes. Oil consumption and GDP have a statistically perfect correlation. Okay. You know, there's a correlation coefficient called R squared, which is just how well, you know, a trend fits a scatter of data. And you take Canada, you take the United States, you take any country, Japan, take Botswana, and you cross plot energy consumption versus GDP. And the correlation is like 0.97. So it's one. It's a perfect correlation. All right. So, and it makes sense that the more you work, the more work you put into your economy, the more productive it is. And most of the work in an economy comes from oil. It's just not that complicated. So, so then there are people, like the International Energy Agency and some others who say, ah, yes, but we are decoupling because of the miracle of efficiency and technology. We are now able to produce more GDP as a ratio of energy than we were before. To which I say, nonsense. You show me a perfect correlation, I'll show you a perfect correlation, and you tell me why it's not perfect. And so what those guys are doing is they'll take, for instance, an economy like the United States, and they'll say, well, look, you know, the GDP has increased, and now you guys are exporting a lot of your energy, or actually using less energy. So there, that proves it. And I say, well, yeah, except that we've exported most of the energy consumption to places like China. Okay, they're using the energy over there, and they're selling us goods and services which don't show up on our balance sheet. Okay, now, so let's stop with this nonsense of, you know, just telling me what's happening in your house, and let's talk about the neighborhood. So let's talk about the world. And what's happening in the world is that the efficiency improvement, as I said in the beginning, is about 1%. And if you think that that's enough to, you know, to continue economic growth at 2 or 3% a year with higher energy prices, then let's see if that works. I would not bet on that. I would not bet on that at all.
Well, let's talk a little bit about responses to energy shortages in the past. You know, I think the OPEC crisis is a great one. It wasn't, I guess, related to geology and technology, but to politics at that point. But this was a major economic shock. And I guess if that R2 relationship is there, that would be the main explainer that you would have for the economic woes of the late 70s into the 80s until we started to recover from that. One of the big responses, obviously, in Europe, where a lot of oil was being used, particularly for electricity production at the time, was a pretty massive nuclear buildout. So nowadays, and I'm not sure if this is related so much to energy shortages, climate concern, the kind of the dominant sort of transition we're heading towards is renewables. I'd like you to sort of compare and contrast those responses, the energy properties of nuclear versus renewables in terms of that response. And as you know, peak cheap oil is here, and we're getting to similar kind of cutbacks as we saw during OPEC. What do you think are the options on the table to try and deal with that? Not solve it and have ongoing 2% economic growth forever and everything's great and, you know, just linear and everything's going to improve. What are your thoughts there in terms of replacement energy?
Yeah. So first of all, at least as far as North America goes, we were doing just great after World War II using natural gas as one of our dominant fuels for heating and, you know, and various other things. And it wasn't until the 1970s that the U.S. kind of ran out of gas or started running out of gas. And we said, oh my God, we better start building out nuclear. But a key omission there is coal. Coal, I mean, we imagine that coal has always been used for heating and electricity. But the truth is that the major build-out of coal and nuclear in the United States was after the energy crisis of the 1970s. So, you know, that's news to a lot of people. But to your question about renewable energy, I mean, I am totally in favor of renewable energy. I am totally in favor of using as little fossil energy as possible. I'm actually in favor of using as little energy as possible. As I said, I mean, to me, that's the solution. But the important thing to understand about renewable energy when we're talking about renewables is that we're talking about electric power, predominantly electric power. Okay. We can slice and dice that a little bit, but that's mostly what it's used for. Okay. Now, and that's great. But the problem is that electric power is only about 20% of total energy consumption in the world. Okay. So let's just say that tomorrow we can somehow, snap our fingers and all electric power in the whole world is generated by renewables. Okay. We have not begun to solve our problem yet because we haven't addressed the other 80%. Now, as far as climate, as far as CO2, if we're able to shut down all the coal plants that are currently generating electricity, that's a big plus. Okay. And that's the part of renewable energy as electric power that I am totally, totally in favor of. Okay. I mean, that's a great, great thing. And that's the reason why renewables are focused on electric power, but it's only a 20% solution to the problem. Now, what about the other 80%? And people say, oh, well, there's electric vehicles. Well, okay, yeah, but, we're talking about a super long process there. I mean, you know, you got something like, 300 million cars, maybe 400 between the United States and Canada. And most of those are gasoline or diesel, and most of those are they got 20 years of life in them. And, people aren't going to drive them to the landfill and buy an EV, assuming they can afford it. And there are all sorts of other problems associated with that we won't get into. But so the bottom line is that the renewable solution is fundamentally a solution for electric power and not very much of anything else. And there are some real benefits to that, but it's not a solution.
Here's my concern and why I swing on the nuclear side rather than the renewable side. I totally take your point. Electricity is a relatively small slice of the pie, although obviously there's moves to electrification and nuclear can do some district heating, low grade process heat. And if we want to really get into high temperature process heat, we need lots of electricity for electric arc furnaces if we were to truly go that way. But here's my objection to the renewable future is, I think energy quality is incredibly important. And what we're doing is using our lowest entropy, highest quality fuels because, wind and solar infrastructure doesn't emerge out of thin air or grow out of the soil, I think, as many green people believe it does. We're using the met coal. We're using the natural gas-fired electricity. We're using the oil for the resins of the wind turbine blades. And we're taking some of the world's most precious energy that's ever been created over hundreds of millions of years, and we're channeling it into these short-lived bits of infrastructure that don't provide heat and basically just provide stochastic electricity. And it's cheap if it happens to be producing when you need it, and it's infinitely expensive if you need electricity and it's not there. So that's why I tend to be more on team nuclear, not seeing it as a panacea. I think there's a value proposition, but it is one of the most technically and institutionally challenging things that humanity has ever put itself to. That being said, in response to the oil crisis in Europe, peak nuclear deployment was 1979. There were 234 nuclear plants under construction in 1979. That was an extraordinary pace of production. I don't think we're, I'm a pessimist, a bit like you maybe, Art. I don't think we're likely to hit those kind of numbers because demographically, the situation is very different. We've deindustrialized the West. Everyone knows how to code. No one knows how to weld. But just in terms of making that comparison between renewables and nuclear, that's why I tend to side on team nuclear again. Not saying it's a panacea and will deliver us from from salvation. But I read your article. Let's move on, I think, and forget about why can't we just get over nuclear? And I'm just curious to explore that a bit more with you.
Well, to me, nuclear is part of the electric power situation. I mean, nuclear, district heating, blah, blah, blah. Okay, maybe in the future. But I mean, realistically, 99% of nuclear's use is electric power. So we're still solving the 20% part of the solution. And even if you allow for all sorts of advances and whatnot, I think in, you know, I've got a, I calculated in one of my recent posts on nuclear that, you know, I mean, we've got to build, you know, like 3 times more nuclear plants every year than we have in the last several years, just to get to 4% of total energy consumption from nuclear. And what do you got at 4%? I mean, you still got a rounding error to zero. So I'm not in any way being negative about nuclear. I mean, I see its benefits. I'm all for it. In many ways, I'm a little concerned about nuclear waste and, you know, and some of the human errors involved. But let's just assume, for argument's sake, you know, that just like a physics problem, that friction doesn't exist. Okay, let's assume that human error doesn't exist and nuclear waste isn't a problem. Nuclear just cannot get there from here. All right. You know, to make it real simple for people, we just waited too damn long and we just don't have enough time. If you believe that there is any planetary or climate window of urgency, and I do, in the next 30 years, there's just not, if all the money in the world were available and all the permit problems and environmental problems were brought to zero, we just can't build nuclear fast enough to move the needle. So again, I'm not saying we shouldn't look at it. I'm not saying we are going to expand nuclear incredibly. And that's another thing I want people to understand. When I say, you know, 4% or 2% is what nuclear is going to end up being by 2050, I mean, that's as a percent of total consumption. So if total consumption continues to go up, I mean, 2 or 4% doesn't mean that nuclear isn't growing. It's growing a lot. It's just that renewables are projected to grow a whole lot more. So again, all these solutions end up at the same place for me, which is they're all designed to try to keep the party going. Okay. And nobody's stopping to say, well, wait a minute, who's going to clean up the mess? You know, we've been partying for 75 years at least after World War II, and we've created quite a mess for the planet. All right. So when are we going to clean up the mess? Well, we'll worry about that later, or, you know, somebody else will do that. No, I mean, that the mess is right now. And the mess is manifesting itself in a lot of ways. And if you don't care about climate change, you know, maybe you care about the fact that we've lost 69% of animal species since 1970. Okay, I mean, that's a stunning number. I mean, in 50 years, we've lost, you know, we've lost almost 69% of fish, reptiles, insects, etc. And maybe you don't care about snakes, reptiles, fish, and all that kind of stuff. But the wealth, the thing that provides human prosperity, is the wealth of the earth. And we're poisoning it with our growth, with our expansion. Okay. And that's the party that needs to stop. You know, we can argue all day, night and night about what's causing climate change and whether it's real and whether more CO2 is actually good for the planet or not. I think that's nonsense, but let's just, you know, back to a physics problem with no fiction. Let's just, you know, if we're poisoning our backyards, pretty soon we're going to have to move out of our house.
And if
what we want is, go ahead.
I was going to come in a little comic relief there. You know, in all seriousness, you know, one of the big sort of positive breaths of energy for nuclear these days is, you know, you had Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, saying we're going to need an energy revolution in order to power all these server farms to run AI. And this is one area where I'm very in favor of renewable energy, because if we're about to be destroyed by an AI overlord, I'd really like it to be powered by the wind and the sun, so that we can have a little German Dunkelflaute and get a second chance to, you know, to what's the Terminator, the kind of evil intelligence in Terminator Sky? God, I'm blanking on my 1990s references here, but you get the point.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, fair enough. Okay, but this is all fantasy, isn't it? So, I mean, and ultimately, the concern I have with all of these imaginary futures is that they are imaginary. They're not, none of them are grounded in what's feasible. Okay. And that includes even the, you know, the International Energy Agency's net zero. I mean, if you spend 5 minutes looking at what has to happen to make that work, I mean, again, I'm not criticizing them. I'm just saying, you know, it ain't happening. It's just not so happening.
Why are otherwise smart people, and I guess I won't comment on the institutions being smart or dumb, but I'm going to infer that they're a bit dumb just for the very fact of producing such documents. But why are smart people doing this kind of modeling and, you know, pretending to demonstrate things, which I think, you know, you in a much more informed position than I am, look patently ridiculous when you step back from it all? Because, you know, I think the climate skeptic side see it and they see it's motivated by, you know, and it is motivated by this earnest optimism. You don't want to accept that your life is coming to an end or potentially there's, you know, species threatening shortages on the horizon. So, you know, this seems very psychological. Like energy is so aesthetic in terms of, you know, the visions that we have for the future. Yeah, it'd be lovely if it were just, you know, natural flows of the wind and sun and we didn't need to build anything significant and we could have the quality of lives that we do. We just don't. But getting back to that question, why do smart people say dumb things in this arena?
Well, that's a smart question, Chris. And they're not saying dumb things. They're just taking a very narrow view of things. Okay. So, and this is what, I mean, this is what pragmatic humans do all the time. I mean, that's sort of.
But this would never, like, you know, say, this kind of modeling would never have occurred in the 1970s and 80s. Is this a question of sort of like hard men make good times make soft men make hard times? Are we in a cycle like that? Or like, I look at some of the, like in Ontario here, we have a document which is planning our net zero by 2050. It says and we're going to increase nuclear by 18 gigawatts. We're going to have 16 gigawatts of hydrogen. They don't really talk about how we produce it. We're just going to burn it. I mean, this is coming from a independent electricity systems operator, frankly, who should know a little bit better, but we're willing to do these pie in the sky plans and assumptions because, you know, we do recognize that climate is very serious. And we're doing whatever contortions we can to try and make it all fit together. But I mean, again, as a medical doctor who's got 4 years of informal energy training, it looks preposterous to me. And not something that would have happened in the 70s or 80s.
So
like, you've been around for a while. I don't know. I just assume that
I'm older and I think a case can be made for the fact that humans are doing increasingly stupid things, but I don't think that humans have gotten any stupider. And there is a nuance distinction there. But I go back to, you know, the answer I began before, and that is, look, if you think the climate change is the existential threat to civilization, then that's the only thing you're going to look at. All right. So what needs to happen to limit the negative effects of climate change? Well, we need to limit it. We need to limit emissions. Okay. So what can we do to limit emissions? And every step down that pathway is a derivative. Okay. I'm getting farther and farther from the underlying reality. And somebody says, hey, I know we can use hydrogen to do a lot of the things that we're currently using oil for. Okay, great. That box checks. Hey, you know, we can use nuclear to do X, Y. Oh, check that. Because all I want to do is get down the road to lower emissions. All right. And what all of those smart people are doing is they're just, don't bother me because I'm on deadline. I'm on deadline to figure out a way to lower emissions. You know, and you know, and Art's saying, hey, wait a minute, where's the hydrogen going to come from? What do you do about the cost? Blah, blah. No. I'm just trying to get to deadline here. And then there's then there's the annoying person who says, well, wait a minute, but all you're trying to do is keep the party going and continue the growth of the human enterprise, and you're not looking at what all this does to the environment, the bigger environment, what it's doing to, you know, to biodiversity and species and pollution. And well, yeah, because I'm on deadline, man. I'll worry about that later. Okay, so I like to think, maybe naively or egotistically, is that there are a few people around, people like Nate Hagens, who's saying, wait a minute, my job is to look at the big picture and try to help you understand how all these pieces fit together. And you know, maybe that's part of what I'm doing and part of what you're doing too, Chris. We're trying to say, wait a minute, slow down a little bit. You know, let's think about, you know, let's not stop doing what we're doing, but let's think about, what if we play this forward? You know, where are you going to get the hydrogen? What are you going to do about the fact that hydrogen leaks through everything? It's the smallest, you know, molecule in the world. What are you going to do about the fact that it's incredibly flammable? What are you going to do about the fact that we don't know where it's going to come from? Whoops. You know, these are kind of problems. So they're still smart people. They're just super focused and their view is very narrow. And they got a dream.
It's been a long time since I read this book, but Bill Gates had a book called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, if I've got the title right. And, you know, what his basic premise was is that right now there's this gap. He called it sort of the greenium between how much an electric vehicle costs versus internal combustion engine. Or I think the only favorable one was a heat pump versus a gas furnace. Already there might be some cost savings there, although the capital cost of changing over a perfectly good gas furnace probably doesn't work out. But suffice it to say, he had this concept of a greenium. Of course, he's stuck in this fantasy and mythology about money and it being detached, I think, from energy, because it seems to me that, you know, we talked about Václav Smil's four pillars. There are pilot projects. We can do green steel, at least secondary steel. There may be some ways, I'm not sure, I haven't looked into concrete quite as well, but there are processes. Haber-Bosch, we could run it with a whole bunch of hydrogen that's produced from green hydrogen. But the only way that these pilot projects are even happening, that we even have the budget to say, let's throw some money at this, is because of the enormous subsidy from fossil fuels, that there's just, we're swimming in this wealth of cheap, abundant fossil fuels. And when that disappears, the pilot projects, let alone trying to pay down that greenium, in terms of the differing change in cost, which I would say is probably related to it differing in energy return and energy invested, seems to just vanish. And that's another reason why I guess I'm a little bit of a serial pessimist on this notion of energy transition. And also why I'm, again, in the advocacy that I do, trying to preserve and build out an energy source where you're taking really low entropy, high quality fuels and turning them to something else that produces, you know, very low entropy, constant electricity or heat, et cetera. It, as imperfect as it is as a swap out, that's kind of the analysis that I've done and why I direct my efforts as I do. Because, you know, I think a little bit unlike Nate, I tend to be a little more on team human, on the humanist side. I have I've got a stake in that. I've got a 5-year-old son, and I'll fight like hell to make sure that, you know, he has a decent life and, you know, not a nasty, brutish and short life. That was a diatribe, Art, but see what you can do with that pseudo question slash.
No, it's fair enough. I mean, I've got 4 kids and 9 grandchildren, so I'm on the human side too. But so, yeah, everything you said, is totally correct in my view. But here's the part that I want to focus on. You mentioned steel and you mentioned concrete. Okay, so. I've looked in great detail to recycling and what actually can be done with recycling concrete and recycling steel. And there's no doubt that we should be doing that. But I got to tell you, Chris, that all of those ideas are just ideas right now. You know, there may be a pilot here and there, but none of those has any demonstrable scalability or economic viability to it. So even if I allow, you know, again, back to no friction, let's just say that, you know, we somehow could continue to have abundant fossil energy. And the only problem with fossil energy is that it's destroying the planet. Okay. So we want to replace it because it's destroying the planet, not because it's, you know, the quality's going down or the cost is going up. We still end up with this huge problem of, well, but we don't know how to do that yet. Or we haven't, you know, we've done it in a tiny little pilot. We know that when we try to upscale pilots, 95% of them fail for one reason or another. So we've taken this little baby step into what an imaginary future of a circular economy and recycled steel and recycled concrete might look like, but it's purely imaginary. Now, again, I'm not trying to say we shouldn't imagine, we shouldn't dream, we should, but let's understand that where we are right now is we're stuck with what we got. We are absolutely stuck for certainly the next decade or two, regardless of the rate of change, with what we got. And so what I'd like everybody to do is, if you think there's a problem, either with climate or with the ecology, and I do, and if you imagine that that might have a relatively short to medium term negative effect on the quality of life for human beings, and I do, everybody should care about that, even if you don't care about the climate and the insects and the reptiles, then it might be worth taking a step back and saying, well, of all these things that we think we can do, you know, to limit emissions, which of them have the greatest probability of being able to expand in the time available? And as soon as you do that, you throw out a whole bunch of them, okay? And so with all those off the table, you know, now things just got a whole lot harder, but a whole lot simpler. What we're doing right now as a civilization, certainly in the West, is we got this fire hose of public money. It's going out there and they're saying, okay, here's, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. And somebody says, hey, I got a great idea. I'm going to invent some sort of a damn carbon vacuum cleaner. Done. Here's $10 million for that. And somebody says, hey, I got an idea. You know, I know how to power a light bulb by screwing it into the dirt in my garden. Okay, here goes $5 million. And if we throw all this money out there, surely somebody's going to come up with something. That's where we're at right now. And I'm not criticizing it. I'm just saying, you know, I'm a scientist. I describe the state of things right now. If we cared, and I'm not suggesting that we should, if we sat down at a table and said, all right, of all those goofy ideas, which ones of them have any possibility of moving the needle, and let's just talk about those, we would make our problem a whole lot simpler, but more difficult. Okay. And what I'm saying is, I already know the answer. I'll save you guys a lot of trouble. Use less energy. Use less energy, emissions go way down. Emissions go down, growth goes down, the human enterprise stops poisoning the planet and incurring, you know, and driving out all of our ecological wealth. That's the solution. And then somebody says, yeah, but that'll mean lower economic growth, and that's bad. And I say, well, which is it going to be? You want to have lower economic growth or you want to die? I mean, that's kind of, you know, I mean, it's not going to happen in my lifetime or hopefully in yours, but that's sort of the existential question we're asking. And what we're trying to do is come up with an answer that doesn't force us to look at either of those. And the answer is so simple. Use less energy. But no one's going to do it. So here's the future. Here is the solution. We know the answer. Nobody's going to buy it. Therefore, nature will impose the solution upon us. Nature will conspire to create a situation in which, because of all the reasons that you described, the decreasing quality of energy, the increasing cost of energy, all the reasons that I described of not being able to solve our problems with renewable energy or not enough of them, of not scaling down the size of the human enterprise, eventually and sooner than later, I think, we will find ourselves in a crisis, a catastrophe, in which supply chains collapse, the financial system collapses. I don't know. And again, I'm not trying to be negative here. I'm trying to say these are the probable outcomes. No,
I know.
There's a difference between objectivity is not pessimism, yeah. Okay? That, you know, that somewhere, you know, the financial overshoot is going to cause a contraction, maybe a substantial contraction of available credit, and that's going to slow the economy. Wars are happening right and left. I'd like to think there are solutions to those, but the pattern seems to be increasing wars, more and more fiscal spending, more and more creation of debt and money that we don't have, which is going to strain the financial system. So, you know, I'm not even talking about the energy supply yet. I'm talking about, you know, Nate's got this great slide, the four horsemen of, you know, the next decade. And so at some point, something is going to happen, and I don't think we're going to go extinct. You know, I don't think it's going to be Mad Max or, you know, or something even worse, Terminator. But it's going to be bad enough that we're going to be forced, not by choice, forced to scale back our activity. And that's a bad way to deal with a tough situation. But I think that's what's probably going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I've appreciated Nate's work because of the way he situates, you know, I mean, again, many, many different facets, ecology, energy, finance, et cetera. But just understanding human beings as any other organism with, you know, we share so much DNA with a banana, for God's sakes. But there is no living organism on the planet that will turn down an energy bonanza. They're going to go eat at the trough and get very full. And we may have sapiens in our name, wise man, but I don't think that from a genetic level we're any different. We're going to have to leave it there, Art. I mean, I'm going to steal just the last okay. reflection. You know, I think I don't disagree with you in many respects. I do think that triage is a concept I bring from emergency medicine, where, you know, really it's a utilitarian philosophy of trying to mobilize available resources, which are finite, to have the maximum benefits. You know, again, which is why I find myself in this predicament, arguing for nuclear power, not as a panacea, but as a potential better option and a way to make the decline a little smoother and less bumpy. Anyway, Art, you know, I think some of my listeners will be a bit frustrated. I talked a bit too much. I wanted to kind of build this relationship and friendship, frankly, and I'd love to have you back to just, you know, pick your brain a little bit more just on some of the technical details, because I think that's a huge strength of yours. You obviously think deeply on the philosophical side as well, but I'm hoping we can have you back at some point to get into driving some technical details, where I will talk a lot less and listen a lot more. But again, thank you, sir, for making the time to come on Decouple.
I've enjoyed it, and I look forward to talking some more, Chris.
Sounds good, Art.